So I'm going to talk about cosmological magnetic fields. I've been involved with this since for maybe 20 years or so. And my plan in this talk is to kind of guide you through the things that have happened and the things that are happening and where the excitement is at the present moment. So I'll start with some comments about magnetogenesis. How do you produce magnetic fields in the early universe? And by early, I don't mean redshift of 10 or something. I mean prior to recombinations in the particle physics era. And I think the remarkable fact is right here, which is that magnetic field generation is linked to the generation of matter in the universe. So if you have matter, it's quite likely that you also have magnetic fields. And then I'll go on to describe some new effects that people are discussing, which are chiral effects in the universe. And it's still kind of what people are thinking about right now. And finally, I'll say something about observations. So there are two viewpoints on magnetic field generation. The first is that maybe magnetic fields were produced during inflation. And I think it was largely motivated by the fact that the space between galaxies are separated by megaparsecs. So maybe you needed magnetic fields to seed the galactic magnetic field. So maybe it's nice to have magnetic fields on megaparsec scales, which is a huge scale. So maybe you need something like inflation to give you that kind of magnetic field. So that there's a large coherent scale, and it's quite obvious inflation will stretch the magnetic field and give you this large coherent scale. But on the flip side, the models seem to be pretty speculative. For example, some will violate gauge invariants, and others have strong coupling, and they're being treated like weak coupling. And the fields that are produced are generally very weak. Another approach is that maybe magnetic fields are produced in phase transitions. And here the models are sort of reasonable particle physics models, approximately the standard model, the standard electroweak model. And the magnetic fields are strong. The flip side is that the coherent scale is small because you're generating these fields by microphysical processes. And so the question is, how can you make these fields to stretch out and become on large scales? And here we'll see that the topology of the magnetic field, as they call the helicity, and chirality of the medium can make a big difference. Okay, so even though you think that there are no magnetic monopoles in particle physics, there are magnetic monopoles. And in fact, now that the Higgs has been found, it's pretty certain that the standard model has magnetic monopoles. But these magnetic monopoles come with a slight twist, if you wish, if they are confined magnetic monopoles. So if you have a monopole here and an anti-monopole here, they will be confined not by a Dirac-type string, not by a solenoid that just returns the flux, but by a Z-flux. So the string is a Z-string, and at the ends are the monopoles. So these are genuine monopoles, just like you have quarks, which are genuine electric charges, and they are confined by QCD strings. So the string has nothing to do with the electric charge of the quark, and similarly, the string over here has nothing to do with the magnetic charge on the monopole. So the standard model does have these objects, and these were first discussed by Nambu in 1977. So imagine you have the electroweak phase transition, and you form monopoles and antimonopoles, and there's a whole web of them. And of course, they're connected by these Z-strings, which are these purple lines. And the Z-strings have the tendency to bring in the magnetic monopoles and antimonopoles, and so they annihilate. The monopoles and the antimonopoles annihilate, go away, but you might still be left with some remnant of that magnetic field in the cosmological plasma. So of course, the million-dollar question here is how many monopoles? I mean, if you have the electroweak phase transition, how can you estimate the monopole density? And here is where the connection with matter genesis actually can be important. If you look at baryogenesis more closely, you have some kind of reaction where baryon number was zero to start with, and then something happened, and then baryon number became non-zero. This process goes through an object, which is called the sphaleron, and the change in the baryon number is equal to the change in the Chern-Simons number, and the Chern-Simons number is defined in terms of the gauge field. So every time you have a change in the baryon number, you have a change in this quantity, which has something to do with the gauge fields. Okay, so that's the sphaleron. So this object through which baryon number violation happens is called the sphaleron. And actually, the sphaleron is nothing other than a bound state of a monopole and an antimonopole. But it's not a simple monopole and antimonopole, but there is an additional twist to it, which makes it a solution, a static solution to the electroweak equations. So the sphaleron is precisely a monopole-antimonopole bound state. So every time you're producing baryons, you're actually producing these monopole-antimonopole bound states, which then annihilate, go away, and you're left with baryon number. And you're also left with any remnant from the decay of the sphaleron. Okay. Well, I don't need to go here, but here you're changing Chern-Simons number, say from 0 to 1, and you go over this barrier, and this saddle point solution over here is called the sphaleron. Well, it's not very relevant here. So that's the story. So now you say, well, when a sphaleron decays, does it produce any magnetic fields? And the answer is yes. Here is the sphaleron. We evolved the equations numerically. And then you produce all sorts of fields here, all sorts of gauge fields. And what you plot here is the helicity of the electromagnetic field that is produced. So the helicity is defined as integral d3x a dot b. What we find is, for example, here, the helicity comes down. It starts at 0, comes down, and then stays flat, becomes a constant at late times. And in some other runs, we found that the helicity becomes positive. So it flips the other way and comes to a constant. And basically, the way to interpret these two different kinds of decays is that the sphaleron is on top of the hill. It can either fall one way or the other way. And depending on which way it falls, either you produce negative helicity or you produce positive helicity. All right. And so what you're seeing over here is that when the sphaleron is decaying, it's producing magnetic fields with a certain amount of helicity. Okay? This quantity is called helicity. It basically measures if the field lines are twisted like a corkscrew, whether they're right-handed or left-handed, or in other words, if the lines are linked together, okay? So it is calculating the linking number of the lines. There's another way you can do this calculation. And the previous thing that I showed you was evolving all the full electroweak equations on a lattice, but here you can do things by hand. In field space, you can actually write down a path that starts from the sphaleron and goes to the vacuum. As it does this, it produces certain currents, and you can calculate those currents during sphaleron decay. And then you can solve Maxwell's equations for the electromagnetic field. Once you have a mu, then you can plug it in here, and you can find how the helicity changes with time. So we've done this, and indeed you start with zero, and the shape is very similar to the evolution we got on the lattice. And so, and this final helicity is minus. So if you produce baryons, then the final helicity is minus sine square of the weak mixing angle divided by g squared. G is the SU2 coupling. And the important thing to note is that baryon production implies left-handed helicity. So this minus sign, okay? All right, so every baryon number that you produce gives you a certain change in the magnetic helicity. And so your helicity density is equal to minus some number order 1 times the baryon number density divided by alpha. Alpha being the fine structure constant. So this is sort of the key formula where you've related properties of the magnetic field in the universe to properties of the baryon number density of the universe. So, this is basically saying that if you measure the baryon density, you've measured something about the magnetic field. And this is very independent of the details of how you actually did the baryogenesis. As long as you produced NB, this will go through. The arguments are very simple. It's almost a topological kind of argument. All right. But so this is the topological argument. And maybe I should have written that formula slightly differently, that the helicity is minus that number times the number density of baryons minus the number density of antibaryons divided by alpha. The reason this is slightly better is that the energy density in the field is then NB plus NB bar divided by alpha, and then there's a length scale that comes in. But the important point here is that the helicity goes as NB minus NB bar, and the density goes like NB plus NB bar, because you're producing magnetic fields no matter whether you produce baryons or antibaryons. So the total energy density goes like the sum of the baryon number violating transitions, whereas the helicity goes as the difference. So the energy density is actually enhanced by this factor, and which I will denote by 1 by delta squared. Okay, and of course that depends on the CP violation in the model. Okay, so now when you have helical magnetic fields, it's very fascinating. Normally, if you have things like turbulence or just some non-helical magnetic fields, they like to drive power to smaller and smaller scales. Once the turbulence or the magnetic field goes to small scales, it can dissipate. But if you have this twisting and the linking, if you have a non-zero helicity, then you have an inverse cascade where power from small scales likes to go out to large scales. So that's why helicity is important over here, because it drives the coherent scale to larger and larger scales. And that's called an inverse cascade. And you can actually calculate, I mean, if you assume a power law growth of the coherent scale, then you get some formula like this. And simulations actually show that this power is alpha is 2/3. All right, so we know how to calculate the coherence length of the magnetic field. All right, so now if we start putting in numbers from the electroweak phase transition, we find that Hubble expansion plus inverse cascade gives you a physical coherence scale of kiloparsecs. So you won't get megaparsecs, but you can get kiloparsecs. If you, there's good evidence that the helicity is conserved during evolution. So the helicity, and the helicity you can write down like this, it's 10 to the minus 21 Gauss squared kiloparsec. And so if your coherence, if you just use this helicity estimate and you say C is a kiloparsec, then you would say that the magnetic field on a kiloparsec scale is 10 to the minus 21 Gauss. But we know that's not the whole story. There's some CP enhancement. So you would expect that B is actually 10 to the minus 21 by this delta factor at times this. OK, so that's a kind of a rough estimate. Of course, we haven't done detailed evolution of these magnetic fields. But this kind of sets the ballpark for such for what's happening. OK, so now I want to come to chirality in cosmology. And this is another interesting aspect which is getting some attention now. The point is that in the standard model, left-handed and right-handed particles have different weak interactions. So left carries SU2 charge, but right does not. So it's possible that the interactions are such that the number density of left-handed particles is not equal to the number density of right-handed particles in the early universe. And so if you're going to talk about magnetic fields in the early universe, then you have to think about introducing chemical potentials for left-handed and right-handed particles. And if you have a chiral medium, then you get some other interesting effects, such as the chiral magnetic effect. And in fact, this effect is showing up in all sorts of places, including Rick physics, because they have the chiral magnetic effect happening in the QCD plasma. Anyway, the effect is simple to understand. You apply a magnetic field. You have a left-handed negatively charged particle, a left-handed positively charged, so that's the antiparticle, right-handed negatively charged particle, right-handed positively charged particle. So the magnetic moments want to line up with the magnetic field because of the mu dot B coupling. But if the magnetic moment lines up, then the spins are flipped in this way. So this the negative guy is flipped down. So the right R minus and L minus are flipped. But then these are, let's think of them as massless particles for the, above the electroweak phase transition. So then their chirality, their helicity tells you that the momentum has to be along the spin over here and here. And then these are right-handed, so it's opposite. And then these charges tell you if the particles are moving in those directions, then they produce an electric current. And the electric current here is going up for the left-handed particles, and it's going down for the right-handed particles. So there's a net current, which depends on the number density of left, EL minus minus NER plus, these two guys, and then the difference of these two guys. And so when you write it in terms of chemical potentials, it turns out that there's an electric current proportional to the magnetic field. And delta mu is the difference in the chemical potentials for the left and right particles. So now you have a current which is going along the magnetic field. And that will turn out to have an important effect. Similarly, there's a chiral vorticity effect, which is that if your medium is has vorticity, then there will be a current generated as well. So, all right. But now the chemical potential is actually a dynamical quantity, because there is a chiral anomaly. So in fact, the chiral anomaly equation can be written in this way, that you have d by dt of left minus right is basically equal to the d3x e dot b. It's like a Chern-Simons integral. So now when you start putting all these together, what you have to do is, in Maxwell's equations, curl B is J total, and J total is the ohmic current plus, say, the chiral magnetic term. And so you get J is sigma E plus this term proportional to B. So we've been looking at this system for a little while, and the MHT equations become that the rate of change of B is this term, which is called the advection term, which if the fluid is moving with velocity V, then it carries the magnetic field along with it. This is the usual diffusion term. This is the chiral vorticity effect, and this is the chiral magnetic effect. So this is one equation we have to solve, and the other is the anomaly equation, so which is telling you how delta mu is changing with time. So once you put these in, then you get the, even if you start with zero magnetic field, this is the energy density in magnetic field, you start with zero magnetic field, what you find is that the magnetic field becomes non-zero, and you get a peak in the spectrum, and this peak keeps shifting to the left, meaning it goes to larger and larger scales, and so the chiral vorticity and chiral magnetic effect are actually giving you an inverse cascade, and initially the helicity grows, but then becomes a constant, and delta mu, which is the difference in chemical potentials, seems to have an attractor evolution. And what chirality does is that it kills off one handedness of the magnetic field, and you're left with the magnetic field being all of one handedness, single handedness. So anyway, so this is interesting, an interesting effect which might play a role in the early universe. We are not, we don't yet have a scheme whereas this would be an important effect, but nonetheless, there is this possibility. Okay, the last thing I want to do is to come to Blazar, to observations. And here the excitement has to do with observations of blazars. And so here's the story, that let's say you are sitting somewhere here, there's this TeV source, so photons of TeV energy, so gamma rays of TeV energy are being emitted by this source. The photon goes and hits some stray photon, say this has to be an optical photon, and then it produces E plus E minus pairs. And then the E plus E minus pairs also have energies about TeV, and they can upscatter CMB photons to GeV energies. So if you have a TeV source, then this blue spot is supposed to be that TeV source, then due to this process, it would be surrounded by some GeV energy photons. Okay? So that's the standard picture, that if you see a TeV source, it must be accompanied by a certain amount of GeV photons. However, if there's a magnetic field over here, then it bends the E plus E minus, and the GeV photons go off in some other direction, and they don't get to you. So with a magnetic field, you would just expect to see just the TeV photons. And so, so Fermi has been looking at these blazars, and Neronov and Wolf did an analysis, and they found that the Fermi data gives a lower bound of an intergalactic magnetic field of 10 to the minus 16 Gauss. So remember, this is a lower bound because they are not seeing the GeV photons. Okay? So they're saying the magnetic field must be at least this strong to get rid of these GeV photons. And of course, this is very exciting if it works out, because this is a new probe of intergalactic magnetic fields, and it seems to be indicating that there is a magnetic field in the middle of voids, for example. And so there's been lots of discussion. There's been some back and forth, and I think at the moment the picture is not completely convincing, but it's not ruled out either. And so I expect the data to get better, and maybe this picture will become clearer. So for the time, and okay, so that's the lower bound. Then of course you can use CMB observations to place upper bounds on the magnetic field. So for example, you can have CMB Faraday rotation. And so what you're going to do is to rotate the polarization. This magnetic field is going to rotate the polarization of the CMB and convert E modes to B modes. Okay? And so you can have CLBB over here, for example. So a nanogauss field at 30 gigahertz observation would produce this red curve for CLBB. Of course, the galaxy would also give some CMB rotation, because the galaxy has a magnetic field, but that, for at least for a nanogauss, that's a bit lower. But if your intergalactic fields are weaker, then you have to worry about confusing these two rotations. All right, so using these, and then magnetic field will also give you temperature anisotropies, and that has also been considered. And I don't have much to say about that, but basically, you can constrain nanogauss strength magnetic fields if they're coherent on large scales. And Giranzik, Catalinic, and Olinto have looked at more detailed recombination in the presence of small-scale magnetic fields, and their claim is that you can go down to about 0.01 nanogauss using those signatures. So you can calculate upper bounds, and some work has been done. I'm not going to go into much detail here, but by and large, the constraint is that on 1 megaparsec, your magnetic field has to be less than about 1 nanogauss. And so here is the summary. It seems like the magnetic field might be in this window of 10 to the minus 16 gauss and 10 to the minus 9 gauss. Of course, there are assumptions in both of these bounds, because they assume some spectrum. But nonetheless, this is a kind of general picture to have. Now, in this, in these analyses, like the upper bound and the lower bound, helicity has played no role. Okay. And if you want to use magnetic fields as a probe of baryogenesis or some early universe physics, you would like to get to the helicity of the magnetic field. So helicity does play an indirect role, because the evolution of the magnetic field depends on how helical it is. So if you can study some spectrum, the energy distribution, then you can get a handle on how helical it is. But it doesn't play a direct role. And so we would like to find some way that some observational way to actually directly probe the helicity of the magnetic field. So again, the helicity is related to the linking and twisting of magnetic field lines. And so since it's linking and twisting, it has to be in three dimensions, right? Otherwise, you don't have any knots. So you want some measure, some way to probe the magnetic field in three dimensions, all x, y, z components of it. And Tina Kanyashvili I showed that you could possibly use cosmic rays. But the problem there was that you had to know the source of the cosmic rays. And so when the cosmic rays came, you could work out some correlators and actually find how twisted the magnetic field was in between. To make this a little clearer, if you have the correlation function for magnetic fields, the I and the J components, at two different Ks, then normally the power spectrum is just one function, right? But here there are two functions. There's the symmetric part and the anti-symmetric part. And the symmetric part is related to the energy density, and the anti-symmetric part is related to the helicity. And so what we would like to do is to have a measure that can measure both A of K and S of K. OK. So I think we've come up with an idea. It's still a theorist's idea. Nonetheless, let me describe it to you. This is with our postdoc, Hiroyuki Tashiro. Let's say you have a blazar, and it sends this TeV photon. It goes about 100 megaparsecs. Then it pair produces, and the pairs go about 30 kiloparsecs. And then the final photon comes about a gigaparsec. That's the GeV. So this is like a triangle. This triangle over here, this is the opening angle for the jet for this source, and that's a few degrees. So you can see this is a triangle which is very long. So this shouldn't have been drawn like this, and then up here. Anyway, so that's the geometry of what's happening, and this bending is due to the Lorentz force, so V cross B. And we are sitting here, and we know where the photons arrive on our plane of observation. So our idea was that maybe better illustrated here is that if you take two different photons with slightly different energies, so dTeV1, and here it's TeV2, they will scatter. They will pair produce at different places along the line of sight. And by correlating photons at different energies, you are basically probing the magnetic field correlator at a certain distance scale between. So this one pair produces here. This one pair produces here. By correlating the two photons that come from here and here, you are looking at the correlation of the magnetic field on this scale. So depending on your energy resolution, you can actually probe the magnetic field on a huge range of scales. So in this case, it's easier to think of the magnetic field correlator in real space. So there are three functions now, Mn, the normal part of the correlator, the longitudinal part, and the helical part. But requiring that the divergence of the magnetic field be zero, it actually relates these two functions. So there are only two independent functions. And when we sort of took this correlator and put it in, so what we're trying to do is to correlate the arrival positions of the photons of different energy. And what we find is that this Mn at r is basically the dot product of these two vectors. So theta 1 is a vector for energy 1, theta 2 is vector for energy 2. So if you take the dot product and you find the correlator, then that gives you the normal part. If you take the cross product, then that gives you the helical part. So if you start seeing GeV photons, which I have no way to assess if that is that will be possible, but if it starts happening, then it might be possible to actually reconstruct the magnetic field correlator based on that data. So I think that's very exciting. OK, so to conclude, there's a tight connection between baryogenesis and magnetogenesis. Fields can have interesting amplitude on astrophysical scales. And of course, if you start detecting cosmic magnetic fields, then you start probing the early universe, maybe the electroweak epoch. And of course, we have all these different ways to look for magnetic fields. And finally, we do have a program in NORDITA on the origin, evolution, and observation of cosmological magnetic fields in 2015. Okay, thank you.
I would like to understand how bad do we need the mechanism for primordial magnetogenesis? Because there are claims in the literature that turbulent plasma, you know, just standard astrophysical processes, can actually enhance a very, very small seed, such as, for instance, second order, you know, perturbation theory in the CMB. Right. And
so, of course, in nonlinear structures such as galaxies, you might have a galactic dynamo. In fact, people claim, I mean, knowledgeable people claim that it's essential that it has to be going on, otherwise the magnetic field would dissipate. So just to keep it up, you have to have a dynamo. So it's true that you have to have a dynamo in the galaxy, but in the void, there's nothing that's going to keep them going. And we don't know how the seed field for the galaxy was created, right? So the galactic field presumably arose from the amplification of a seed field, and the challenge is to provide that seed field. And so one thing is, if you start seeing things in the voids, then there's no way to have a dynamo. And the other thing is, maybe you need it even for the galactic, even to seed the galactic dynamo.
Yeah, so, I mean, what I was referring to is the following. Like, in the CMB, by, you know, electron-proton separation, you can form a magnetic field, which is really, really small.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there are people who claim that by amplification through turbulent plasma, this field can get to the levels that we see now in galaxies. And then, I guess my second question is about voids. I mean, voids are surrounded by, you know, galaxies, and mm-hmm. so what about the, you know, magnetic fields penetrates into voids?
Sure, by, sure. So people...
Is this realistic or not? What's your take on that?
Well, people do think that you can have magnetic fields produced in galaxies and then blown out of the galaxies. And there's this question of what kind of energy budget do you need to spread the magnetic field out in the voids. So a lot of these questions are not settled, I think. About the CMB, I think there will be some magnetic field, but I don't know if that's at a stage which can be amplified. Do you know?
Yeah, I don't remember the exact number. It might be like 10 to minus 19 Gauss, but probably somebody knows better than me. And the point is that I saw papers in which they claim that the amplification is essentially infinite in turbulent plasma. So, yeah, but maybe we can talk later
about that.
Mike Rinkoff from the other side.
I'd just like to, well, just add to that previous comment, in that certainly you do have really strong application of possible for magnetic fields and accretion disks around black holes, say massive black holes, electric nuclei, which do get blown out.
Uh-huh, yes.
Over very long distances,
uh-huh.
And even in voids, well, they're not completely empty, and in the early universe, when active electric nuclei were much more common, one can imagine that even you could deposit magnetic fields even in the voids, but how all that works out in detail, I don't know. But
yeah, I guess as they find more blazars, for example, they might... more data would come in, and then we'd be able to say better I mean, we would be able to distinguish between different mechanisms.
Yeah. Any more questions? If not, let's thank Tanmay again.